Hey everybody, welcome to another monthly installment of Tap Room Talks. You may have noticed there's not any music or whim this time around because this is a very special episode. Now, isn't it, Craig?
That's right. We are hunkered down in our sour room bunker facility right now because it has the best acoustics right now to do this.
Coincidentally soundproofed, by the way.
That's right.
This is a live panel recording of our Trailblazers panel.
That's right. Yeah, this was a really cool event that we did this past Monday, and we got a lot of the heavy hitters and the top guys that are really kind of got this whole movement in North Texas started for us, and we got them all on one stage, talked about everything about coming up in the industry, how they got started, and did a little Q&A as well.
Yes, so this installment and the next one, the next downloads in your queue. The first one will be just the panel. The second one will be the QA. It's about an hour for this episode, about a half hour for the next one. And we're back on our regular schedule next month. So until then, enjoy the panel. Enjoy the QA. That'll drop tomorrow. And bye,
adios.
Everybody. Ponder that, but I just can't think of anything. Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you guys so much for coming out. My name's Wim Benz. I'm the president and founder of Lakewood Brewing Company. Thank you guys for coming out to our Trailblazers panel. Our esteemed guest, we have Keith Schlabs, the operating partner of Ado Management, co-founder of Flying Saucer, where a lot of us, I'm sure, drank our first beer. We have Fritz Rahr, president and founder of Rahr & Son Brewing Company in Fort Worth. We have Dennis Verman, am I saying that right?
Good.
Doing my best. Founder and brewmaster of Franconia Brewing Company up in McKinney. We have Tim Diener, our very own Tim Diemer, who is our head brewer here at Lakewood Brewing Company. We have Jamie Fulton, who is the brewmaster at Community Brewing Company, or Community Beer Company, I should say. Rick Ali, owner of Lone Star Beverages and Taps and Caps. We have Brian Brown, beer historian, co-author of North Texas Beer, a full-bodied history of brewing in Dallas, Fort Worth, and beyond. And last but not least, we have Dan Heinzerling, the brewmaster of Humperdinck's Restaurant and Brewery. Let's hear it for our panel. We're just going to get right into it. If each one of you can just kind of go down the line, kind of tell us how you got into the brewing industry, what you're doing in the brewing industry, and how long you've been participating in the brewing industry. And we'll start with Dan.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wim. Thank you all for coming out. I've been brewing in Dallas since 1997. I've been with Humperdinck's. I've been the head brewer at the Greenville Avenue Humperdinck's since 1999. I graduated from the American Brewers Guild in 1996. Worked in California for a year before moving down to Dallas. I'm actually I have second seniority with Humperdinck's. Our brewer in Arlington is Alan Sparkman. He graduated the brewing school in the spring of 96, and he's the longest continuous brewer in Tarrant County at our Arlington location.
Brian Brown, kind of got my start in beer in 1998, ironically, when Humperdinck's was still Bighorn.
Yep.
Brewing with Bighorn Hefeweizen, really my first craft beer. Went on to become a BJCP certified judge. Started writing in 2010 for Examiner. A couple years after that, started my own website, Beer and Big D, and then along with Paul Hightower, we wrote the book North Texas Beer 2 years ago.
That's quick. I'm Rick Ali. Rick Ali. I started in 2006, so 10 years ago. I don't have a brewery, but I started my first bottle shop in Carrollton 10 years ago, and fell in love with craft beer, and Carrollton went wet, and I said, why not open a beer store? Realizing that it wasn't as easy. But now, 10 years later, I have four shops, three growler shops and a bottle shop, and still going strong.
I'm Jamie Fulton. I started homebrewing in college while I was studying art history, which I got a degree in. Had a job lined up at the Kimball, and after my dad paid for this expensive education at Trinity, I remember calling him and saying, hey, I want to pursue brewing, a career in brewing. And I was nervous as hell. And he said, well, thank God, Jamie, you don't belong in a museum. He's like, you know, just pursue it, you know, like you should. My parents are both doctors. So went to study in Germany, graduated from Siebel Institute. Concurrently, I was doing apprenticeship at Blue Star in San Antonio. After I got back from Germany, opened the Covey Restaurant Brewery in Fort Worth, 2006, at the ripe age of 23. Closed that 2010, and worked for Newland Systems, a brewery manufacturer, for a couple years. Then opened Community Beer Company in 2013. We sold our first beer, so still doing that. 4 years now.
Name's Tim Deemer. I've been brewing for, I don't know, 24-something years, 25 years. I started in 1995 at the Hofbräu on Knox Street, and I ran that brew pub for till about 2001. And I left there and went other places, went to the machine shop business for a while and decided that wasn't for me. I wanted to get back into the brewing business, so I went to Siebel's Institute to get my certificate because there wasn't anybody left around that knew who I was, and except for Dan over there, and started volunteering here with Lakewood, and now here I am, head brewer.
All right. My name is Dennis, Franconia Brewing Company.
Oh, man. Here we go. I can hear myself now. So, I started brewing. I can't really tell you what year it was, but my great-great-grandfather started 1800, opened his first brewery in an area in Germany called Franken, translated Franconia. So I grew up in the brewery. My parents put me to work when I was 6 years old. I had to scrub the floors and the tiles, and I did my first batch of beer when I was 12 years old. Graduated in Munich from the brewing school in 97, but worked my whole life in the breweries and moved here to DFW in 2003. Worked for a brew pub chain at first for 4 years and opened Franconia Brewing Company almost 9 years ago.
Good evening, I'm Fritz Rohr with Rohr & Sons Brewing Company. Kind of like Dennis, I was kind of born into a beer family on the malting side and grew up entirely around beer my entire life. Went to Siebel Institute in Chicago, did some work over in Germany at the Durst malting facility, and we opened up our brewery in Fort Worth 12 years ago. So.
Hi, I'm Keith Labs. I'm with the Flying Saucer. And my whole life, I've been in restaurants since I was 15. Worked my way through college, moved to Dallas. Thought I would go to grad school, did not do it. But an interesting thing happened while working with corporate America. A buddy of mine knew that I liked beer. And at that time, Sierra Nevada was kind of the go-to. And he said, hey, there's this brew pub opening on Henderson Avenue. And I think you need to check it out. It's called Yewa Creek Brewing Company. And they'd already gone through, it had already opened. And I went to check it out. I met with the owners and was hired on fairly quickly. I think he needed somebody with the corporate background and experience. And what was interesting to me is the excitement about craft beer. I mean, it was so different than just managing, you know, a chain restaurant. It was excitement about craft beer. Every customer that came in was, you know, eager to tell me what they knew about craft beer. And so I actually learned a lot through the customers. And I thought that I could probably do a brew pub. And I was young and eager and went to Fort Worth and happened to run into a restaurateur there who invited me to help him open Flying Saucer. And so in June of 95, we launched our first saucer. And then he just wouldn't stop going. You know, we were building as fast as we could. It was exciting, you know, sleepy little downtown, Sundance Square. All of a sudden, here comes this little beer joint, and we just haven't looked back. It's been a fun journey, and I've met some of my best friends in the world in craft beer, my wife in craft beer, so it's been good to me. And for the last, I guess, 23 years, you know, I've been selling their products, and proud to do so.
Well, let's kind of keep going on that path. You know, I think beer in DFW, I think as far as most of us remember, it started in the brew pub scene, right? It started with Hofbräu and Humperdinck's and Yewa. What can you guys kind of talk to us about what the environment was like then? What made people decide to start opening up brew pubs in the early to mid-90s?
Well, not being an owner, I mean, I can't speak to that. These guys have brewed for them, but I remember Toby O'Brien, who opened Yewa. As soon as the legislation passed to allow brew pubs, there was a wave of people that were interested to do so. And the first one was Waterloo, I believe, in Austin, Texas. And then right behind that, I believe it was at Yewa Creek. And, Henderson was hard to get to at that time. It's where the dram is now. It's before 75 was constructed, but we would pack it out, and it was an amazing time. So I think people that enjoyed craft beer were excited about the opportunity.
Well, and for us, Humperdinck's we used to be part of a national chain called Bighorn Brewing Company that originated on the West Coast, and they wanted to branch out across the country, and Dallas was their first foray. And there was also Rock Bottom was similar in a chain that was looking to branch out. And, a lot of them didn't make it for different reasons, but we came in pretty solid. We opened all three breweries in pretty short order and came in with brewers ready to go. And I think a lot of the early brew pubs, a lot of the brewers were home brewers to start with and had gone through the formal education process, and that was great. I mean, there were guys that really knew how to make great beer, and they were kind of learning on the fly how to make great beer professionally.
Yeah, at Hopbrow, I was just two blocks in off of Henderson. I was on Knox Henderson. We used to trade malt and stuff all the time. It was tough to get down there sometimes because they, right about the time they started tearing up 75, I was living in Plano, and it'd take me about 35 minutes to get to work. Nope, not after they tore it up. It took me an hour and a half. So nobody came down that area during that time. So that became problematic. But yeah, he's right. Pretty much all of us started out as homebrewers. There was a few people that came into town that were professional brewers, but most of us started out at the homebrew store. I ran Homebrew Supply. Yewa had the Tominator. He was at homebrew headquarters. He was there for a little while. It was just a group of guys trying to make great beer and ended up getting good jobs doing it. So,
do you guys remember what your big sellers were back in, 20 years ago at this point? On the brew pub side?
Yeah, we went through everything. I mean, it's funny, we've got the flyers on the table that advertise the 25 fine ales and lagers for pretty much all the breweries in Dallas got together and did that tasting. Six of them were IPAs, five of them were amber ales, and then the rest were browns. I mean, everybody had...
No, there was a couple porters.
There was porters, and we had a Hefeweizen. Like you said, we had a real German Hefeweizen early on. But, yeah, when it first started out, it didn't matter. As long as it wasn't clear and light-colored, people would just love it, as long as you made a good product. And there were a lot of really good beers back then, but there was not the breadth of style that there is now.
Well, one thing I'll say is, one of the interesting stories from back then is Rock Bottom. They came in, and if you read back in some of the old Dallas Morning News interviews with the corporate people, they were saying, after the brew pub legislation passed in 1993, we came down, we opened up a brew pub, and we just decided we're just going to bring our culture down there, and everybody's just going to love our beer. They didn't do any kind of marketing, any kind of education or anything. They just assumed that Dallas was so hungry for this new product that everybody would just jump on it. Well, after a year of kind of lackluster sales, they kind of stepped back and said, okay, well, this market really doesn't know a whole lot about beer. It's really a really fresh market. So what a lot of places did, Rock Bottom, Copper Tank, what they would do is they would give you a sample. If you bought a Coors Light or a Bud Light, they would give you a sample of their lightest beer to try to get you to cross over. So what Rock Bottom did, actually, they brewed a beer. They were really staunchly against having independent recipes in any of their restaurants as a national chain. They wanted to brew all corporate recipes at all their locations. But what they did here, because they were trying so hard to get the Dallas market to cross over, was they brewed Dallas Light to try to literally change the attitudes of local drinkers here. So
what are so we saw all these brew pubs come in, do well for a little bit. Do you think it was just the natural course of a business cycle where that led to the downturn and the sort of the cutting back of brew pubs in DFW, or do you think there were other things at play?
Well, if you go back and read a lot of the reviews back in the day, I mean, think about a brew pub, you got to be good at two things. You got to be good at beer, you got to be good at food. If you're good at one thing and not the other, well, half your customers are going to go somewhere else. The other thing that happened was within like 2 years, 14 or 15 brew pubs opened in a really short span of time, 94, 95. So you think about, we're a really young market, not a lot of people know a lot about craft beer, so your market segment's really, really small. If there's one or two brew pubs, you're gonna have those customers regularly, night after night after night. But all of a sudden, if there's 14 brew pubs within a 6 month, 1 year span, well, they're gonna go try the other places. Okay, we went here this night, we're gonna go here the next night. So all of a sudden, your revenue drops,
because all these people are, your regular customers are now have other choices. So then that just falls back on, well, if you weren't that great at beer to begin with, for example, or great at food, and somebody else comes on and they're good at both segments of the market, that's where they're gonna go. So that was a factor. I mean, another factor was, you know, some of the people that got into it were kind of just in it looking to make a buck really quick. It was one company that ended up, they basically got bought out, and what they did was they started making video games. Like the video game systems, the trivia systems you see on the video screens. So there's a variety of things, but I think in a lot of ways it was just too much too quickly for a really young market. So,
what, you know, if you can think back, I think there's a lot of millennials in craft beer. There's a lot of people under 30. There's a lot of people in their 30s. What was the demographic like back in the 90s?
Older male.
Yeah.
I was drinking Bud Light from Industrial Boulevard.
I was an anomaly in the homebrew club. I'd go in and all these old guys would be like, okay, who do you belong to? Who's your grandfather? No, I don't know anybody here. This is my beer. Oh, no. That young kids don't drink this. Right. You know, it's changed now. You know, we used to have, kids would come in and Hofbräu had other beers. So they would order the Bud Light or the Miller Light and whatnot. And their dad was over there drinking my porter. And that's changed now. You know, that's part of the reason for the success, I think, is because there's a larger group of people imbibing.
Keith, I want to get your perspective on that too. Starting out with a brew pub, then going into, you know, the bar side of things, when there was a little bit of a lull between, you know, the sort of the drop off of brew pubs, between that and then the rise of, you know, production breweries. How have you seen the demographic change over the last 15, 20 years?
Well, we still have, you know, an older clientele at times, and luckily now there's a wave of younger clientele that come in right behind them. But, in the beginning, I think at Yewa, I saw a lot of people that had traveled, maybe that were in the war or just traveled abroad. They would, you know, experience great beers, and our brewers were trying to, you know, replicate that style and doing a pretty good job of it. The younger clientele generally, I think, you know, were price conscious, you know, and when we started the Flying Saucer, you know, I was writing a beer menu and I really couldn't pronounce half of it because it was from Bamberg or, you know, Nuremberg or somewhere like that. And we started, you know, that UFO club that got people interested and gave them a reason to try all the different beers. But even then, you know, the primary member was probably, you know, 30 to 50 years old. And luckily, you know, we see in every market that we occupy that craft beer is something that, you know, is not the fad that I think a lot of people thought it was back then. And, you know, young audience, as you probably know yourself, they're just excited about craft beer.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're seeing the styles kind of go back to more sessionable beers and not just, you know, incredibly strong, interesting, you know, beer. So, but yeah, we've got a great audience for craft beer these days. I think we're all blessed to, you know, have that.
I think you're right about the price being a sticking point for the younger crowd. We used to, we'd have $2 Tuesdays. And that was, I mean, we'd just sell the place out every Tuesday night. And the rest of the time it was more about, how many beers can I drink? Not, you know, can I have two really interesting beers? It's can I have 10 really boring beers? And that seemed to be the driver for a lot of the restaurant business in Dallas. So when we came in, you know, a lot of that was challenging the way that people drank. I mean, people that wanted a flavor experience were drinking wine or mixed drinks, and then the beer drinkers were just trying to pound as many as they could. And we had to re-educate them in a lot of ways to pound bigger beers.
You know, I made a mistake. When we first opened, I realized immediately that, you know, how am I going to get through this keg of Bateman's Triple XB? You know, I need to do something to drain that keg, otherwise I'm going to be sitting on some stale ale. So we started a fire sale, and every day you could come in and get cheap beer. And I think that, you know, spoke to that audience. But I did make a mistake. On Mondays, we would do $2 pints, and For some reason, I thought it would be okay to put Moretzu in a pint glass and sell it for $2.
Oh, good Lord.
And we were so popular back then, you know, but people would come and try to drink five. You just have to be more responsible today, but I regret that a little bit.
That's funny. I started, my beer drinking experience started at the Saucer on Greenville. Back in, when did I turn 21? In 1999. But yeah, it was my 21st birthday, and it was a Sunday, and I went there at midnight. And I'd been going there maybe, you know, for some time before that, before I was actually 21. I'll confess now. But yeah, I was after Belgian beers, you know, because that's, being from Belgium and having traveled back and enjoying those beers there, that's what I was after. And that led me into American craft beers. Sierra Nevada, Red Hook, you know, some of the bigger guys that are now still around, obviously.
Yeah, but Anchor was big.
Yeah, that was sort of the start. And my girlfriend was a waitress there, so that didn't hurt either. So, moving on.
Hey, you know, we did have Michael Jackson, who we learned a lot from back then because, believe it or not, it wasn't internet. And we didn't have the Google box to figure things out. So we read the World Guide to Beer and tried to educate ourselves and then our staff. And Michael came to do a series of tastings, and we had him at Greenville Avenue. And it was pretty exciting. And I was really happy to show him my list of beers and let him pick, you know, what he wanted. And he looked at me in disappointment. And the only beer that he wanted at that time on his the tasting was Timmermans Blanche. He thought that was the most interesting beer that we had. So the market was really soft back then. It just wasn't the depth that you have today.
Yeah. So let's move on to Brewpub Wave 2. With the Covey and Two Rows.
I knew you were going
to
go.
You guys were... We had to get you eventually, right?
Yeah, I guess.
So you guys were sort of round two brew pub, right? Second wave. How would you classify it? Beginning of the craft boom?
Yeah, in Fort Worth, I guess. I mean, RAR... when did you open, Fritz?
2004.
So yeah, I opened the doors 2006, and yeah, I mean it was I was really young. I was a young brewer. The market was very young for craft beer, and you know, first and foremost, as a brew pub, you're a restaurant, mm-hmm. and you know, there was a lot of hiccups when I first opened with the food. I think the beer was always pretty good. It definitely got better as I you know, the years went on, but you know, I wrote a piece a couple years ago for North Texas Beer Week, just about you know, a brief history of Texas and some of the funny comments I heard at the Covey. You know, when you went in, the brewery was all behind the glass, and you know, people would say, "What are they making back there? Tortillas?" You know, you're going into the Covey restaurant and brewery, not tortilleria. Very, very funny comments. Well, you know, if it was better than Budweiser, they'd be brewing it. I considered it the last frontier in brewing, and I just felt like I was on an island. I was not a veteran in the industry. I wasn't a member of the Texas Craft Brewers Guild, which I'm now on the board of directors. So I'm really tied in now a lot. But I felt like I was on an island there. I talked to Fritz occasionally. We would bounce stuff off each other. But, you know, I don't have the resources that I do now then. And so I kind of had to figure a lot of the things out on my own. And I obviously never figured out the customer base there in Fort Worth. So, yeah, after pretty much my lease was ending, that's why I closed it. But, you know, it was a very challenging thing there. We were making great beer. I mean, we won many GABF and World Beer Cup awards, and you know, it didn't help that the economy tanked, but it was challenging there in Fort Worth. I always considered it the last frontier. Yeah, all my buddies had, you know, many, they all knew each other from Pennsylvania. I'd go hang out with them, and I was the guy from Texas. And now it's like, us from Texas, I mean, 2 years ago, we were like the fourth most winning state at GABF. And I remember winning a medal there, and some guys right behind us, St. Arnold's won a medal. Some guys right behind us is like, we're all wearing our Covey shirts that clearly says we're from Texas. And he's like, well, it's good to see somebody from Texas is brewing some decent beer. You know, and this was kind of, you know, this was, Texas was not known for good beer. And you fast forward to now, not that long ago, you know, and now we're brewing amazing beer all across the state. So, but I'm happy I'm not running a restaurant anymore. That's for sure.
Well, that pretty much sums it up. Happy not running a restaurant. When I moved here in 2003, I was hired by Touros as their corporate brewmaster, pretty much. And when I got here, I was, when they told me their numbers, how much beer they were selling, I couldn't believe it. I said, as a brew pub, it's impossible. But what they did, and Humperdinck's did a $2 Wednesday, I believe.
$2 Tuesday. Yeah.
$2 Tuesday. So Touros, I guess, followed to try to steal some business, pretty much, and they went with $1 Wednesdays.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, literally, now we are going away from the mid-age or older crowd. We literally pulled in a lot of the college kids.
I was there.
You were there.
I was there.
Which the, and I think that that's a big part too, depend on where those brew pubs were located. Touros, the first Touros was located on Upper Greenville Avenue. The second Touros was located in Houston in Rice Village, right down the street from the university. So, and if you can buy a $1 pint of beer, you know what kind of clientele you're getting in. And we sold literally on a Wednesday, we sold about 30 to 35 barrels of beer on a Wednesday night. It was unbelievable. But even here, it was the lighter beers, blonde. We had an American wheat beer and then the Hefeweizen, which came a little bit later. So definitely, but for me, I just couldn't get into the restaurant and brewing. That I always brewed beer. I think I would be bad in a restaurant. So that was a little bit, so that really brings it down to if you want to run a restaurant or if you want to run a brewery. So, but it was a very interesting time for us.
Well, and the $1 Wednesday turned into the hose down the sidewalk Thursday morning.
Yes, yeah. Yes, definitely, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, I will say that, you know, getting into that, you know, I was the brewer there. I did everything in the brewery, but I opened the brew pub because of my passion for food. That's what kind of led me into brewing. And, you know, it's so challenging running a restaurant and trying to be a family man at the same time, having kids and a wife. And, you know, I still love doing beer dinners, but that's probably the only thing I miss about the restaurant was our semi-monthly beer dinners and pairing it up with my executive chef Sean Merchant, who's still my best friend. But yeah, that's probably the only thing I miss about the whole thing.
Well, free lunch was good.
Yeah, definitely I was a little bit heavier back then. A lot more options to eat, but
And I think what also falls into that for me, at least, if we brew beer, you know, we're taking pride in it. We, you know, want to make sure we are putting good product out. And then you're getting told that you have to sell your product for $1 a pint. It's a little bit a hit under the belt line, if you know.
Well, but when we first started, our first brewer was Jared Topman, and his assistant was Tom Yannick. And Tom had a degree from A&M. He had gone to the Siebel Brewing Program. He had a food science degree from A&M. And he started out as an assistant brewer at that location. And he had to, you know, he was the daytime hostess for the lunch crowd because that's what they thought of brewers was, oh, well, you're the assistant brewer. You can go ahead and seat people for lunch and, you know, get everybody's drink order and all that, too. So, you know, there was a certain amount of overcoming the lack of knowledge as to what exactly it is we do.
Do you guys remember Rob Cromie, who brewed at Yewa? Rob Cromie?
No, I remember Tominator, Tom Nelson.
So Tom was his assistant, but Rob was a really tall, blonde-haired guy. He used to tell me that he could run the restaurant better than I could. And so, you know, I would gladly give him my keys and let him try. But he was a gold medal winner. He did really well. You know, he was the second brewer there. And guess what he does now? He's a restaurateur in Houston and has like five successful restaurants and is kicking butt. I'm proud of him, man. I guess he's right. He probably could run a restaurant better than me.
Well, the last brewer there, Jim Sipp, he's at, if he's still there, last time I talked to him, he was at Red Hook in Portsmouth. He was the head of cellar operations.
Wow, good
and
for
he
him.
He was your last brewer, and he left there and went up, and he did well for himself.
That's good.
Been up there since.
Yeah, met a lot of good people there, so that's good.
Fritz, you've been awfully quiet, so let's talk about the rise of production breweries in North Texas.
Right.
You obviously leading the charge there. Well, tell us what was it like in your day?
Way back when? It was interesting. You know, I left a very successful career in the railroad business, and when I told my parents what I was doing, after a few four-letter word expletives, they thought we were completely crazy. And it's kind of funny because I think my wife and I, when we decided to take the plunge, we were living down in Houston at the time, and we were attending the St. Arnold's tours frequently and really liking that. And growing up in the business, she kind of looked at me and says, well, why can't we do this back in Fort Worth? And I said, really? You want to do that? And she said, sure. I said, okay, let's go do it. And literally 9 months later, we were building a brewery. And we kind of think back on it now and kind of joke and laugh, thinking if we would have really given the idea 5 minutes of thought, that we would have thought we were crazy and never have done it. But we literally just kind of jumped into it. And we were committed from the get-go. We had basically sold off all of our assets to get into the business. And when we first started, it was challenging in North Texas. You know, Austin had their thing going. Houston had kind of started their thing. But up here, there really wasn't much of a movement, especially in the Fort Worth market. And when we started, I remember selling beer to the Saucer September 16th, 2004, very first kegs of beer that we sold, and we had tremendous support from the Saucer, and there were just a couple of beer bars really in existence at the time, so we were out selling beer into sports bars and any place we could find it, you know, places that only had 2, 3, 4 taps. And I remember one time selling beer into a midtown location and came back a few days later and I noticed the beer was gone. I was like, okay, great, it didn't do well. I walked in, they'd actually purchased 2 kegs. And I said, you know, how are things going? I mean, the beer's not on, was there a problem? He goes, no, the beer is great. We sold out yesterday. I said, oh, you went through 2 kegs? Yeah, I said, how do they like it? People loved it. I said, okay, are you gonna order any more? And he goes, no, we're gonna put XYZ back on. I was like, well, it sold so well. Yeah, but we get this, and this from the distributors and the breweries. And, you know, it was very difficult to play in that market when you didn't really have anything to play with except quality beer and being the young guy and the new guy and the local guy. And at some places that worked well, but everywhere else it was very, very competitive for those 3 or 4 taps, as you can imagine. You got Bud, Miller, Coors, Shiner, and maybe an import. And it was really, really a challenge. We almost closed the brewery on 3 separate occasions. I had to lay off my entire staff in 2005. I did everything at the brewery except packaging on Sundays, when we had a group of volunteers that would come in to the brewery and help me package on a very antiquated old bottling line. And my wife had to go get a job because we needed health benefits for the kids. And there were times when I was putting in 36 hours a day in a 24-hour period, sleeping up at the brewery, and word got around that I had a mistress called Bruana, and because I was sleeping at the brewery all the time. And it was, you know, the first 3 or 4 years was a real struggle. It was really hard to get people to make that switch over to craft beer, even though they really liked it. They were so brand loyal to the big three that it almost had to go to therapy just to get them to admit to themselves that they tried something that they really, really liked. So it was definitely a challenge those first couple of years.
Okay, so this is a question for the entire panel. where did you see yourself in 2016 when you started? Were you thinking that far ahead? I wasn't.
You know, it's funny. I just had this conversation with a lot of people in my family and some of my partners. I remember we got this big 20,000 square foot warehouse, and we had this little brewery stuck way over on the far western wall, and we had six little fermentation tanks from Summit Brewing Company out of St. Paul, and a little bottling line. And it took up maybe an eighth of that warehouse. And the rest of the warehouse I used for coaching my little league, my son's little league baseball team, playing poker, soccer with the kids if it was raining outside, you know, all this stuff. And I remember sitting there going, you know, one day maybe, just maybe, we'll have fermentation tanks that line all the way down the center of the brewery, along the far wall, and we'll be busting out space and then trying to plan and design a greenfield new brewery site because we just don't have any room. And I didn't know when that would happen, but I had envisioned in my mind beautiful stainless steel tanks all over the place. And today, we're kind of at that point. We have stainless steel fermentation tanks everywhere, equipment everywhere, packaging equipment everywhere, dry goods everywhere. We've got about 40,000 square feet, and we don't have any room. And so when you make that comment, it's funny, we were just talking about that the other day, but remember when? And we're kind of there now.
It's kind of interesting, the whole, you know, the remember when, you know, for some of us hasn't been that long. You know, we opened up our brewery in 2012, so we just hit four into our fifth year. And, you know, we kind of joke about, well, we wrote our business plan, and we were going to add one employee every year. And we were going to max out, you know, at around 7,000 barrels in about 7 years. And, you know, I think, you know, for me and Jamie both, we've seen incredible growth just over the last couple of years, and it's been definitely a big boom. And we threw the business plan out the window about 6 months in. We were like, well, this is going in a completely different direction than we had planned. So we're blessed with that. But with that, it brings a lot of people that I think try to get into the industry, and this will kind of be our next talking point. A lot of people that get into the industry may just be in it for the money, or may just be in it because craft beer is the cool thing to do and they can, you know, make a quick buck. I will tell you, for one, that's not the way it works. And I think, you know, from the manufacturing brewing side, you know, all of us have seen a lot of increased competition. You know, we're seeing acquisitions happen. You know, Revolver was acquired by Miller Coors, Carbach just recently by ABI. It's a completely different environment than it was maybe even 18 months ago. So we're in this place now where everything has just sort of gone into hyper mode. She's gone to plaid. Anybody? No? All right. Thank you for the people that get that. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about sort of this hyper mode that we're in, especially the last couple of years, where it's just been this explosion of craft beer. You know, we were the fifth to open, and now we're looking at 30 plus breweries in DFW.
Well, let me just for a little perspective there.
Yeah.
Since the first brewery opened in Dallas in 1857, there's been roughly about 120 brewing operations in that 150 years. Today, there is 54 active licenses. So if you think about right now, today in history, almost half the brewing operations that have ever existed in North Texas are active right now. So that's basically what you guys are all dealing with. That's how much it's exploded. Because I remember going to a tour at Rahr & Sons back in 2004, and I was one of seven people. And I'm like, okay, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if this is going to go anywhere. But then over time, you know, Dennis opened, and you know, a few breweries came and went in that time. We've had a couple brew pubs come and go in that time. But now it's just like we're averaging basically a new brewery opening over the last 5 years since Deep Elm opened in 2011. A new brewery is open on average every 6 weeks up until today. So that's the kind of growth we're dealing with on an everyday basis. We're averaging 8 to 10 breweries opening every single year. So that's kind of the environment that everybody's working in at this point in time. So.
Well, I think it's also interesting if you look at it, because you said the buyouts, they happened. You know, I speak for myself and maybe for some of you guys too. You know, they really work in the industry and see the back of the house too. I think the buyouts we have seen wasn't really a surprise. You know, I think you can tell from the beginning who is setting up their business to sell it as fast as possible and grow as quick as possible. And then you see the people there just trying to do it to have fun and, you know, really do something for the community. So those buyouts, I don't really think were surprising that they happened. I have to say, when Fritz started, it was definitely a very interesting time, and you know, he had quite some challenges to go through, which we followed 2 or 3 years later. And so it was very interesting. If you looked at the market, like Fritz said, it was pretty much raw in Franconia against everything else that was out there, yeah. Distributors, domestics, and it didn't took very long. And I think the talk was out there that Fritz and I, we don't get along, which exactly, which honestly, at this point I had met Fritz once. So in his brewery, I was out there, took a little tour at the brewery, and we talked for a few minutes. Your head brewer,
was that with Hudak?
Yeah, well, I was afraid to say the name, but yes, that's exactly right. It was with Hudak. So otherwise, I've never met Fritz, and the funny thing was, you know, people talked about it, how Fritz and I don't get along, which there wasn't any base for it, and Mel, which, you know, one of Fritz's really good salespeople, I was sitting together at bars with her, and we were making fun about it, what other people talked about us. So, and then going into the, you know, going along into the time where we are now in the last 4 years, I think you said 50 breweries we gained. I think at this point we have to be careful too that not the same thing happened, what happened with the brew pub, like Brian said. Yeah, sure, North Texas can handle many more breweries if we have, but I think everything happens really fast right now. I was born and I grew up in the biggest beer region worldwide with 380 breweries in 40,000 square miles. So that's a lot of breweries. And if you look at the geographics, you know, the bigger beer areas, and I even count Austin to that, they have a lot of breweries, but that happened over 20 years. Here in Dallas, we gained 50 breweries in 4 years. And I think that plays a big, big role. The market is there, the people, the consumers are there, but I don't think we're giving the retailers, the bars, and the grocery stores enough time to adjust and grow into that. And I think we have to be careful for that too. And there might be some cases where people think twice what they're doing and how they do.
Well, let's continue on that. On that side of things. So let's talk on and off premise. So on and off premise is industry speak. So on premise, you're consuming it on the premises. Off premise, you're taking it home. All right, everybody follow? Cool. So we have our on premise retailer. We have an off premise retailer. Well, I guess you're a little bit of a hybrid at this point, right? So yeah, well let's talk about that. You know, Keith, when you guys started, it was 2 local breweries, you know, or none when you started up. And then you know, here we are at 50. And how does that play into your business models? I mean, I think yours is built upon it. And I mean, it's sort of ridden, you know, you've been riding the wave.
Yeah, when we opened in 2006 at the time, it was really much not much. I think Dennis opened up maybe a year after we opened up. And so, and Fritz at the time, I don't know, Tony Formby was around at the time with your brewery. So we only had them two. And then I had Dogfish and mostly all regional brewers. So it was a lot of local stuff. I couldn't fill up a full door of craft beer at the time, but I knew I loved that stuff. And it's kind of slowly progressed where, if you've been to my shop, we have a beer cave, which is a walk-in cooler. You can walk in and check out stuff. And when I opened the shop at the time, I literally had
pallets of 24 packs of Bud Light and they're like Coors Light because that's what everybody was buying. And slowly over time, kind of migrated, we started getting more breweries opened up and a lot more breweries came available where we switched it. And we're now, the craft beer is majority local stuff. And so people want what's new and what's local, which is great, you know, but the problem becomes now is that running out of space, like you said, there's so many breweries and every brewery is trying to get the first to package. And now there's cans and there's bottles, there's bombers. And it literally is, you're almost at the point now where we're substituting breweries for other breweries. So now we're like, okay, well, locals are selling like crazy, so we'll just substitute a regional brewer for a local one. So now you're just constantly just rotating out. And we're a big shop where smaller stores may not have the space. So now you're really taking away from each other. And in the end, consumers now, they're really supportive and they're buying a lot of locals. So it's great because you're seeing the sales, but essentially who do you get rid of? And it comes down to now, and for me, it's kind of fun because really, not only one, it's supporting local, but now you're kind of creating this thing even locally is you're kind of forcing each other to make better beers. So essentially, you gotta be better than your neighbor now because not only one am I judging the beers coming in, but then two, the consumers are getting more educated in what's out there between the breweries and with the Flying Saucer and us, kind of really educating the consumer on what's out there and what you're drinking, what you should be expecting. And so now you're really, the consumer's getting smarter, so now they're demanding better beers. So not only one is, hey, I want local, but I want the best IPA is available. So it's definitely a challenge to keep growing and getting everything in. It's been interesting, for sure.
Yeah. Keith, do you see, there's Flying Saucers all over this great nation. Do you see hyper-localization of beer? Do you see that becoming a trend where it's not good enough? You know, it's not good enough to be from Texas. It's not good enough to be from DFW. You have to be from Dallas. You have to be from East Dallas. You sort of this pinpointing with all these new breweries coming on. Do you see that on your side?
Yeah. I mean, if we, you know, in the beginning, we couldn't even fill a draft wall. You know, I mean, it was a lot of imports and that sort of thing. And then Rogue Ales, you know, gave us a lot of different SKUs. You know, and the distributor back then might have been Glazers or C.R. Goodman or somebody like that was committed. And today, you know, I remember one of my restaurant managers, who's just a great guy, he's in Raleigh. But he's like, Keith, man, this is so frustrating. I'm trying to run a restaurant and a beer program simultaneously. And I mean, it is a full-time job. And so what I've done is kind of worked myself out of the beer procurement and given it to my, you know, Landons in Fort Worth or Mark Castaldo and I've got guys that are really good, maybe in North Carolina, that can kind of look after that market for me. But if I let my customers, you know, curate the beer list, it would be all local, right, you know, in the vicinity. And what the reason why I even brought up Rogue and you know, those guys, you would send us Golden Gate, you know, or kegs with the Hop Steven and the Golden Gate. We're trying to figure out how the hell to tap this thing. how do you even pick it up to even count it? But, you know, I have to think about everyone that brought us here. And, you know, we learned about craft beer from, you know, brewers in Belgium and, you know, great breweries in London and small, you know, craft brewers, you know, abroad. And then Sierra Nevada and, you know, Anchor, all these different breweries, you know, afforded us beer when we couldn't find it, you know. So I have a different perspective having been in it for a while. I mean, I kind of, you know, I like Adam Avery and I like, you know, Garrett Morero and I like, you know, the guys that brew good beer on a national level. So it's a delicate dance there, you know, to support local and to, you know, support those who brought us to this place and, you know, the pioneers. And, you know, I think Rick had it right, man. I mean, you know, people know about beer now. I mean, I've got a customer who didn't know jack about craft beer that was studying to get his PhD downtown Houston, and he has made it a mission to drink every Texas beer that we pick up. And I think he has something like, you know, 10 plates with not even any beer other than Texas. So he could tell you every little nuance of this pills versus that pills. It is a very educated market. I think people do kind of chase the whales, the white whales, they call it, you know, the special beers that you do that are bourbon barrel aged or, you know, I can't believe it. You know, you'll have a line from here to you know, across the street if you release a 120, and I don't know that that beer is very drinkable, to tell you the truth. But, you know, it is important to pay respect to the local and to take care of local businesses. And it made me feel good, man, that you tapped your beer at our place. And, you know, I know that Landon and Mark and those guys support you today big time. And, you know, they love you, man. You're like family. So we want to see local businesses grow. And, you know, we're proud of you guys, you know, for doing what you've done. And, but, you know, unlike Rick, you know, I've got 80 handles, so I can, you know, I can play around with the mix a little bit. And we've been trying to get, you know, maybe European beers back in and to see how they'll do. And we're starting to create a different type of menu to, we even have this thing, it's called Ghost Beers. And we'll put on 6 beers at a time and not tell anybody who they are. And, you know, they have to order them and then they can rate them and see what they think. And what's interesting is we've launched it in Fort Worth and in Houston, and people are not rating the beers they thought were so good, but they're rating the beers that they didn't want before very well. So we'll release that beer and tell them what it is. And it's been a fun experiment to see how that works. But yes, I mean, quite frankly, it's kind of hard for me to keep up with all the beers that are coming out at me. You know, I went skydiving with my father-in-law in McKinney, and I don't think I've ever, well, I've been there once, but, you know, I had Tups, you know, and my guys know that exists, you know, but in Addison, you have Bitter Sisters. There's just a lot of breweries coming at us, you know, and probably like, you know, the late 90s, you know, I think the strong will survive, but what we're seeing is this brew pub type model where I think they can sustain themselves a little bit, you know, just on the business that's on premise for the brewery. And, you know, that's probably a good thing for them.
Are we approaching a peak? Are we seeing a bubble? Anyone?
That's way above my head, honestly.
You know, I think in talking with a lot of my friends in the industry around the country, maybe getting close. I think the big regional breweries are seeing a hit. I think when you have Sam Adams come out and they're down 20%, and I have friends with a big brewery up in Minnesota, they're down about 20%. All across the board with these like super regionals or big regionals, and you know, in Minneapolis, they've gone through the exact same thing. They've gone from 4 or 5 breweries in the city to now over 60, and their size is nowhere near the size of the DFW area. And they're starting to see all the competition happening, and there's going to be some fallout. And just like in any life, or what's the word I'm looking for? Life cycle of any industry, you know, you're going to see a mass surge, and there's going to be a fallout, and it's going to go along for all. Then you'll see growth again. I mean, it's just going to keep happening over and over again, probably as we continue down this road. So, at some point in time, I think there's going to be something that happens, and it may be not necessarily anything to do with beer. Maybe in an economic thing, it could be a bubble in the economy, a fiscal bubble that bursts, and it's just, you know, super inflation or recession, and then you might have a lot of breweries that fail just because of that.
Right.
So there's my doom and gloom.
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely one of the limiting factors now in growing a brewery, getting it bigger, especially a production brewery, is finding talented people to work in it. And I've had people come from a big brewery that sold, and they didn't bring us any beer from the brewery. And he said, "I'm not proud of it. We've grown too fast. The quality's not good. I brought you other beers from our area." That's just sad. Like, I don't want to be in that position. And I've you know, for one reason or another, we've grown community at a, you know, pretty reasonable clip, and I'm happy with that, because it is the hardest thing to find is talented people to do it. And there's plenty of passion. And I think what's great in North Texas is a lot of these breweries that have opened have started small. And I forget who said it, but they've started with a model that is fairly sustainable. When I hear about a brewery saying, "We're going to open the doors we're going to have a 100-barrel brew house. We're going to do, you know, 40,000 barrels the first year. It's just like, man, it's just not going to happen. You know, where are you going to find all the people to do it, for one? That's great. You've got a lot of money. You've got some drive. You obviously want to grow it and sell it. And it's very apparent who's doing that. But I think what's really cool about North Texas is most of these breweries that are opening are people that are very passionate and are brewing great beer. And I'm very involved. Everybody knows that I've got lots of hops to sell, and I've pretty much sold hops to everybody in the area. So it's fun to be a part of that. And we you know, for the most part, we all play in the sandbox, and I like it that way. But you know, people that are just getting into it for money, it's you know, there's a few of them in our area. But you know, I'm really glad that most everybody is in it for the passion and. Man, but just finding the people to staff this, that's the limiting factor. And the last three guys I've hired in my brewery have been oil and gas guys. I mean, one of these dudes graduated from UT with a petroleum engineering degree, and he's now working probably a third of what he was doing. But he's a hard worker. He's from a little town in Texas, and he's doing really well. And so, yeah, it's... I'd say that's one of the limiting factors, and one of the reasons we are going to see a peak in this is we're running out of people to head these operations up. You get somebody with a whole lot of money and say, I want a head brewer. Where do you get him? You got to pay somebody more.
Which isn't then an opportunity?
What's that?
Why is there not somebody out there? And it might be us. Maybe we come up with a plan here. Which I, since I'm here, since 13 years, I think, why is there not more education going on in the beer business? Why is there not a real program where people can go in, a 2-3 year program, and really learn how to brew beer on the theoretical side, on the practical side? I mean, come really up with a program and do stuff. There's always some movements here and there, but I really haven't seen anything where even the breweries go in it and help to grow the people we need.
Well, there is the Eastfield program, so that, you know, and that's starting, and I think that's starting to to gain some traction. There's been a lot of interest, and we've had some students come through on a weekly basis and kind of, you know, learn how to scrub floors and take bottles off the end of the line.
Well, but I mean, is it enough? What we brewers need, what we are looking for.
Maybe not.
No,
maybe
it's not. I mean, I got a guy that comes in the door and says, I want to work in the lab. I'm a lab guy. I'm like, I've got a guy that works in the lab. He's like, well, I've got a microbiology degree. I'm like, I'm not hiring in the lab. And he gets all put off and leaves. And it's like, when you work in the brewery, you do everything. Like, you start out, you're popping six-pack carriers at my brewery. I don't have machines to do all that. Funny story, I bring my little boy to work with me, and he's over there with one of my guys popping six-pack carriers, and it's the bane of all of our existence. And he said, Andrew, this would be a whole lot easier if you had robots to do this. And he's like, Jamie, tell your dad that. It's not that you've been to school and you've put in 6 months learning about it. Do you have that sparkle in your eye? Are you a hard worker? Are you going to get along with everybody in there? We're working long hours, and we're all really, you know, getting in the grind together, and you just got to get along as one of it. It's really just got to be part of the matrix of the brewery, at least in the production setting. That's kind of...
I think there's an ample supply of people. It's just that the markets in our major cities that already didn't have a big craft movement that now does, it's just eaten up every single really good qualified person. And, you know, I see the Davis program going, a lot of different programs. There's some new programs up in the Oregon area. And I think there's more and more opportunity for people to get involved, and I think more and more people have. It's just we've expanded so fast, so quickly, that all those people have been gobbled up. Yeah. And now it's really hard. It's really hard to find good qualified salespeople who want to go out and work really hard in a very, very difficult market. It's tough to get qualified brewers. And to be perfectly honest, I think we all go through this on the production side of the brewery. Is, you know, Jamie hit it right on the head. You might get a guy who knows his stuff, but if they don't get along with everybody else, it's bad news. And that bad news can create an overwhelmingly huge bad news issue within your population inside the brewery. Mm-hmm. And for me, managing growth is probably one of the most difficult things we had. You know, staying open was difficult, growing the business was difficult, but actually managing the hyper growth that we're all seeing at this time has been one of the most difficult things. And one of the things is maintaining your culture inside your brewery, making sure everyone's sure. still staying cohesive, because one person can really upset that whole thing and cause a real problem.
You bet.
So it's a real difficult thing.